This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project with Dr. Robert L. Ordonez. Today is March 22nd, 2006. It is approximately 2:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, and we are on the telephone. Both of us are in Lubbock, Texas. I'm on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Vietnam Archives interview room. Dr. Ordonez, I'd like to start with, first of all, what we discussed before we began recording, which is the process of the interview. And I'd like to ask you for a verbal yay or nay, whether or not you agree to do the interview, that you're aware it will be made public, that this is doing the interview, you are agreeing to donate this interview to the Vietnam Archive, and that you understand the legal disclosure and interview agreement that you did sign.
Yes, I do.
Okay, very good. Well, sir, let's start with some biographical information. Could you tell me where you were born,
Robert,
when you were born, and then tell me a little bit about your childhood?
Okay, born in Albuquerque, New Mexico, 1949,
mm-hmm.
and raised in a very traditional family. Had parents and brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a World War II veteran,
mm-hmm.
and carpenter by trade.
Mm-hmm.
Went to public school and then went to Catholic school for a few years, then went back to public school.
Okay.
Graduated from high school in 1967. Was involved in growing up in sports and Boy Scouts, and lots of summer jobs, and just very active in my little community. We were very family-oriented and very traditional.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your parents, your mom and dad.
They're both from Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Okay.
We still have family there, and at the time we used to travel a lot to Las Vegas, New Mexico, which is about 2 hours away from Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, being a World War II veteran, was in the National Guard when the war broke out, and went straight to Sicily and up and spent 3 years there in the war.
He was in the Army.
The Army, right.
Okay.
And he was very much involved in veterans organizations later on, American
mm-hmm.
Legion, DAV,
mm-hmm.
the Veterans of Foreign War, VFW.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was as a housewife. She raised us all in a very, very good, very close family.
Okay.
And they both had 2 years of college,
mm-hmm.
and that was it.
Okay. And you said you had one brother and one sister?
Yes.
Kid, are they older or younger?
I have one older sister and one younger brother.
Okay. So you're stuck in the middle.
Right in the middle.
Okay. Do you want to just tell me briefly about them?
My sister's a year older. My brother's a year younger. And so we were brought up very close together. And we all went, of course, to the same schools. And my sister did not graduate from college. She went into college, got married, started raising a family, but she's been very successful at what she does. She works for the university, and she also does taxes on the side. They've had little businesses before her and her husband.
Mm-hmm.
My brother graduated with an architectural degree and became a city manager for a long time until he retired, and now he's back into managing plans management, and getting retired from another job, and my sister has three sons.
Mm-hmm.
Her and her husband have three sons, and my brother has one son, and I have three sons.
Okay, very good. You said, you just talked a little bit about you went to public school, and then you went into Catholic school. How were you academically, and tell me about your hobbies growing up?
Well, academically, I've always done very, very well. I graduated in the top 5% of my class in high school. And hobbies, I was mainly involved in Boy Scouts since I was 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of camping. I loved working with animals and did a lot of ranch work and horseback riding and working on cattle ranches and a little bit of rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a carpenter by trade, and we helped him on the weekends. We learned that trade, and we also, on our own, my brother and I learned automotive, and we used to work in cars a lot growing up in high school.
Hmm. Was this more of a hobby or something that you were thinking of, well, I can do this as a career?
No, none of it was ever a career.
Okay.
Growing up, I never knew there was such a thing as a hobby. We just did things because we liked to do them.
Right.
And everybody
right.
else did them, and we all did them together.
Yeah. So your dad was a carpenter, and you learned that skill as well.
Oh, yes.
So early on, did you enjoy working with your hands and taking apart, fixing things?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay. And tell me about your sports involvement. You mentioned that.
Yeah, lots of track, cross-country in high school and intramural basketball in college.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, plus also we enjoyed a lot of outdoor things like hunting and, well, mainly hunting, bow hunting, rifle hunting growing up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was Albuquerque like in the 1950s growing up?
Albuquerque in the 1950s was a city of about 100,000, maybe 150,000 at the most. It was a very community center type of city. We were very social, had a lot of friends, a lot of time at friends growing up, and the community that we lived in, it was we lived in what's called a little barrio, that's just a little Hispanic community.
Right.
And it was, I don't know, I thought it was very warm. People shared things together, and neighbors, and everybody was very close, and there was... you could never do anything wrong because your neighbors would always tell the parents. And very lots of respect, lots of honor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a rough city. It was a very, very decent city. It became rough later on.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, it was the same thing, too. We had moved from one sector of the city to another sector. And in grade school, I guess about the sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
from the South Valley to the North Valley. And again, it's predominantly Hispanic where we lived in, and that's where all of New Mexico is anyway.
Yes.
And nothing really special. It was just a very enjoyable, had a very enjoyable childhood, with relatives and friends,
mm-hmm.
cousins, and we were always doing things and just always very active. And if we weren't enjoying ourselves, we were working, and I enjoyed working, helping my dad remodel. Mm-hmm. It was always just so much fun. And I don't think we ever had adult moments growing up.
Sounds like you had a really good childhood and very close to your mother and father and your siblings.
Yes.
Do you all remain close to today? I mean,
yes, very much so.
Okay, very good. Tell me about your high school years and, your social networking, sports, academics, and of course, I want to know about emphasis on education within your family and what led you to your going to college and your advanced degrees.
High school, the ninth grade, I went to an all-boys school.
Okay.
And it was primarily a vocational-type school. Just went there for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
I took electronics in the ninth grade and learned how to build radios, and it was very, very advanced. Did very well academically. My dad, my mother had such high standards for us, we had to study. Very, very disciplined. We could not bring home poor grades, and so it is a pattern and just natural for us to study hard and to do very well in school. And so I've always done very well in school.
Okay.
Me.
What were your favorite subjects?
Well, I loved them all. I did not have a particular favorite subject or I loved math. I loved science, and I loved history. Even English was not that bad. It was very good. I love sports, physical ed. We excelled in that. And
what kind of sports were you into?
In the ninth grade, that's when I started in track and cross country. I just had a lot of speed.
Yeah. Were you naturally smart, or was it a combination of your brain and your mother's?
The thing is people think that intelligence is inherited. Some of it is, but most of it is acquired. And it has to do with discipline within a family.
Mm-hmm.
And when people do not have high intelligence, it's usually because of a birth defect. Again, that's a physician me coming out.
Sure.
Either cerebral palsy or, just little injury when you're born. And sometimes dyslexia can often be mistaken for lack of intelligence. I have two sons that are dyslexic, and one of them had a full scholarship to A&M, and he's an engineer, the youngest in his team, and he got a job 2 weeks out of college, and he keeps getting promoted. He's highly intelligent, reads,
mm-hmm.
and he's very dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a myth. And As far as ADHD, all boys have ADHD. I mean, I go into trouble all the time. My kids have been there, but you know, you just channel it, and if you have good parents who can channel that energy, it can be directed to the right way. And our parents we lived in a very modest home, and we're not people of means, but yet we had tremendous pride in what we did and who we were, and it was just expected of us to do well. So as far as intelligence came as far as acquisition, because I don't believe that I'm really overly intelligent than anybody else, but I do believe that it's just a lot of hard work and a lot of addition, where you add up and you come up with a lot of knowledge after you've added it up.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you saw that through your father and his hard work, what your mother expected of you all, and the structure you had.
Yeah, and they were both readers. I mean, they bought us books. They read to us when we were children. Mm-hmm. We had encyclopedias that they paid on payments, and it was very, very, I mean, the encyclopedias were like heaven. We just love, as kids, we used to love getting into them on rainy days, and mm-hmm. sunshiny days were outside with all the kids getting dirty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In high school, did you have a kind of an idea of where you might go? I mean, were you thinking college?
I was thinking, there's no doubt that we're going to go to college. There's absolutely no doubt.
But your sister went first, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and so, I mean, it was expected for you and your brother.
Right. I mean, it was just, we were just going to go. That's all there's to it.
Okay.
And my initial, after, during high school, I did very well. I mean, I liked all my subjects. I got very high grades, and socially, we had a little group that stuck together during college, too. We just were, it was just a typical, nice high school-type environment, nothing adverse, no trouble or anything. We were not troubled.
Mm-hmm.
There's kids who were troubled, and we usually knew why. It's because of poor home environment.
Mm-hmm.
And with us, we were just like anybody else. I mean, we did the sneaking around and things that got us into trouble, but we got severely reprimanded, and so therefore it was not a pattern in our life. It was just experimental.
Right.
And that's all.
Your father was in World War II, and he went into a really difficult theater in Italy. Did you guys ever discuss this?
Always.
Oh, yeah?
He was very open about it. He was very open. He was very fluent in French, German, Italian, mm-hmm. of course, Spanish. He was, he was a linguistic person. And he told us a lot about his stories in the war. And, in fact, we would go see John Wayne and Audie Murphy movies uh-huh. together. And he was very open about it. He was in demolition. He was a sergeant.
Okay.
He got wounded, too, when he was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
I mean, in World War II.
Did he fight for the duration of war?
The whole duration, 3 years.
Okay. And what do you remember most about what he told you? Is there a particular incident or just a memory that comes to mind?
Well, the Battle of the Bulge was the worst. He went into detail on that and he talked about the German prisoners and the things that he received a lion's claw from one of them and kind of learned German from him. He had to guard this one German prisoner and became somewhat of friends. And then when the Germans started pushing in the Battle of the Bulge, they had to, in a second, just that in the evening, leave everything behind and just take the rifles and canteen, and that was it. And they had to flee.
Wow.
And that was the way it was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah, yeah, very intense.
And the things that always impressed me was when the shells would come in and young people would die, it's just like I just couldn't imagine what he was going through.
Yeah. When you were in a war yourself, did all that stuff come to you?
Oh yes, very much so.
Yeah. I take it he was probably supportive of the fact that you were in the military, and especially when you're involved in a war.
Right. My dad wrote to me. My mom's, I learned this later on, my dad has since passed away, he died of cancer in 1987, but while I was in Vietnam, he would write letters to me that would take him all week to write. He'd have a trash can full of crumpled up papers in which he would continually correct himself until he had the perfect letter, and I received 1 to 2 letters a week the whole time I was there.
Oh, wow, wow.
And he would tell me about the mortars coming in, about how to guard myself, and I would always lie and say, oh, no, we're okay. We're not seeing any of that. We're not seeing any action.
Right.
But he read right through it.
He knew it. Yeah, that, that's incredible. He would give you advice, actually, to how to survive in a war.
Yeah, he did. He really did.
Well, moving into the college years, you know, tell me what you did after high school and then getting into...
After high school, I attended University of New Mexico. I was an architecture major.
Okay.
And I loved art. I was a school artist in high school. I even drew professionally for a couple of little magazines as a high school student. And, didn't really take formal art except for one class my last year. They actually made me take art because I was already making money out of everybody else doing art.
Yeah.
I was self-taught in art. And so I took architecture because I could put in a little bit of the building, which I liked, and some of the art that I liked. And I was very discouraged with architecture. I just did not like it. I did not like the liberalism of most of the artists that were in the fine arts department. And everybody's pretty much very left-wing. And I was, so college was, I went in college liking it at first, the first semester. By the time I was done with my first year, I was very discouraged about college. It just, the war was going on. This was already 1968.
Right.
And Tet Offensive was, had already been going on, and I was between my my freshman and sophomore year. I went back to work at a ranch. I worked for the Department of Interior, and we developed a wildlife refuge in up by Las Vegas, by my home. And I decided that's what I would change to. I would change to wildlife management because that's what I always loved the outdoors and loved animals. And at that time is when I was going to change. But my aunt, we were a very close family, so anytime I was not at home, whoever I was near took over as a parent. So my aunt took over as a parent, even though I was already 19 at the time. She told me, says, you stay in school, and you know, because I was seriously thinking about going into the military. I was just so tired of it, the way, you know, the way things were, Kent State and Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated that year.
Yes.
And it was very, very discouraging to me, and I just wanted to do what my dad did and just go into the military.
What years were your college years at?
I started in 67.
Okay.
And I graduated from high school in 67, so I went that calling fall. And then I did three semesters. I did the first year, 67, 68, and then I did the fall of 68. And at the end of the fall of 68, towards the winter, my grades really dropped. I was just very discouraged at the time. And it wasn't that the fact that I was partying or anything. It's just that I just didn't like any of the subjects I was taking. I really hated architecture by that time, and I did not like, I was really not liking college life. I was not liking the people over there. I liked a lot of the people who were there, who I was befriended with, but the professors and the vast majority, they were into the anti-war protesting, which really was extremely discouraging. And at that time, I decided I really wanted to go into the military. My dad highly discouraged me. He said, you don't want to go into a war.
I mean, this is during the war, and you still wanted to go in.
Yes, I did. And
why was that?
Sense of duty and also adventure.
Okay.
And my grades got so bad that I was drafted, I guess I did it on purpose, and because back then that was before the lottery, so you had to have a college deferment, and the lottery didn't come into effect until 1969, and. So I guess just subconsciously just kind of let things slide. And my dad still talked me into going to the Navy. And he said, well, I want you to go into the Army because you don't understand what war is about. And I really didn't think he knew what he was talking about. I thought that I knew better. So, but anyway, I went ahead and listened to him. And I, along with several other of my friends at the time, we all quit college together. One of them went into Marine Corps. The rest of us went into the Navy.
Wow.
And
what did your mother think?
My mother, she, no matter what decision I ever made, she always backed it up. And she said, just take care of yourself and do the right thing. And she was always very, very encouraging. And she didn't get very emotional about it. She was, you know, glad that I was in the Navy and not in the Marines or the Army.
Right. Let's back up a little bit into your high school years. And we discussed what it was like in the 1950s, Albuquerque. But going forward into the 60s and America's involvement in Southeast Asia, What were your thoughts about that? I mean, you're going through some formative years there in high school.
What
were your thoughts? What did you know about?
We knew very little. When I graduated, by the time I graduated from high school in 67, the war was just peaking out. In 65 is when Johnson really sent a large portion of troops out there. And very few of us knew people who were in the war until we got into high school. Then all of a sudden, high school students who were just 1 or 2 years ahead of us were writing back home saying that they were in the war. And never really knew any of them. And you just heard stories, and it was like it tickled our curiosity as a young man, mm-hmm. and especially as an adventurous type person. And the news would come out with dealings about Vietnam. And it wasn't until Tet that they really started coming out. But they'd have the number of people dying that week in Vietnam. They'd mm-hmm. have all these things going on. And I really thought that, well, you know, my dad's right. I don't want to go over there. But as time went on and the protests started going on and we started learning a little bit more about Vietnam, I really became very empathetic with the cause of stopping communism.
Mm-hmm.
And people were not understanding really about what communism was, in that they said it's just a form of government and they need it. But actually, it was a form of totalitarianism that just took rights away from people. And
mm-hmm.
and our country, my dad fought for the war, for their country, the way, the freedom that we had. And we were in the Cold War, and we had a best government in the world. Which I thought then and which I still think now.
Mm-hmm.
And we enjoy a tremendous amount of freedom. And just hearing what these iron or bamboo curtain countries underwent, I felt that, you know, people are asking us for help, and why not? You know, it's a price to pay.
Tell me what you thought about, start with President Eisenhower. What do you remember about him?
Oh, Ike. Golf. Nothing. Lazy. Lazy.
Golf.
That's it. That's all I remember. I mean, it was a general, and he was like a has-been. I really wasn't impressed. Kennedy, I was very, very impressed, as we all were.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the ninth grade when he was assassinated.
What do you remember about that day?
Oh, man. It was my dad came home, and we came home, and we all took off, and we all watched it together. My parents were Democrats, but that didn't matter, you know, because Kennedy just had such an allure and such a charisma to him
right.
that the whole country loved him. The whole country loved Jackie, you know, unless you were a college professor and, you really didn't get involved in politics that deep. You just knew what was on the surface, and what was on the surface is what the country needed. And mm-hmm. he was just a very outstanding young man, and he was in his 40s and youngest president we've ever had and all that. And then when he got killed, it was just very devastating.
Yeah. For us. Do you think that shifted the country in any way?
Like
a lot of people.
Yes,
have
it
said,
did. Yes, it did. Oh, it did a lot.
Like a loss of innocence.
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Did it affect you in any way like that? Did you say,
no.
"Oh my gosh, I see the world different now"?
No, it was it was like couldn't believe it's happening. It's not supposed to. That stuff is not supposed to happen.
Uh-huh.
But when you're in high school, very little affects you. If it doesn't affect the school, it doesn't affect your friends, it doesn't affect you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way teenagers are. And it's hard for them to become global. You don't become global until you get a little bit more mature.
Yeah. So after November 63, Johnson takes over. What do you remember about him in his early years there, before he's your commander-in-chief?
Well, Johnson did not have the charisma as a Kennedy. everybody criticized him because mm-hmm. he was put himself into shoes that he couldn't fit, and so he was under the gun
mm-hmm.
by everybody, including my parents. My mom didn't like him.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Because I mean, he took the place of our president.
Right, right. Well,
that's what I remember.
Okay,
that's not what you would admit to now.
Now. Going back to what you were saying about why the United States was in Southeast Asia, you talk about stopping communism, the aspect of the Cold War. Did you see, at that point, the Vietnam War as part of the Cold War, or did this kind of come later?
Oh, I saw at that point it was part of the Cold War.
Because
Kennedy Kennedy's plan to get us in and out of Vietnam, he had a plan, and so he escalated the war into sending from an advisory to expanding from an advisory to actually combatants. Mm-hmm. And his plan was to go in, mop up, and get out.
Right.
And we all expected that would happen. But when Johnson took it over, he couldn't stop the flow. It didn't seem like it was like a dike that had a little hole in it. He didn't know how to stop it, and it just got bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the anti-war protests while you were there in Albuquerque, and you know, seen it on TV, but also I guess witnessing it there on the campus. Can you comment on that? How the effect it had upon you, but also what you saw?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of organized protests done on campus, and they would have people with loudspeakers and talking against the war, and a lot of the songs too were beginning to become very anti-war, and what we saw on the TV just kind of correlated with sort of what was going on in the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to them, you know, there a lot of them were very convincing. But these were young 18, 19-year-old kids who had never been anywhere but home, high school, and college. And yet they're talking about where we should be as a country. And I looked at them and said, you know, they don't really have a leg to stand on. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
I listened, and I listened to them with an open mind to see if they had anything to say. And I didn't hear anybody that had anything good to say as far as convincing me to feel otherwise what I felt.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents react in any certain way, especially your father as a veteran?
He just kind of cursed them. That was it. All those, you know, hippies and all that stuff. But he said that there's no such thing as a good war. That's what my dad would say.
Hmm.
There's no such thing as a good war. I wish we could get out of there. However, you know, if we got to be there, we got to be there, and sure, if we can get it done with, but don't, you know, just don't throw the baby out with the water.
Right. Well, going into the military, into the United States Navy, what were your expectations about doing that? What did you think would happen?
Well, I thought that I would see the world. I thought that I would be involved in fancy schools and electronic schools and getting an education into areas that I had never thought, nuclear. Submarines, all of that. I thought I was going to be doing all of that.
And
I didn't, because I'm colorblind.
Oh, yeah?
And I could not. And even though I scored like the 99th percentile on my test, and they told me I could get into any school I wanted.
Okay.
And, but when I was in, of course, I took the physical, and I was colorblind, and I couldn't get into any school.
Hmm. And you had no idea you were colorblind before that?
Well, I learned I was colorblind my senior year in high school when I took an art class and I was mixing oranges and greens, and I thought it was the same color.
Mm-hmm.
But being an artist, it's really hard to be colorblind.
Right. But you were still naturally good at art.
Oh, yeah. I know what to do with the colors.
Uh-huh.
If somebody's there telling me what to do, I could do them. In fact, you know, I still do a lot of that now.
Okay. Well, tell me about leaving, I guess, Albuquerque and then going into a basic training.
Well,
this is 1969. Is that correct?
It was March of 69.
Okay.
And I couldn't leave any sooner. I probably left sooner. I would have.
Mm-hmm.
And it was March 3rd, 1969. I went in, and we went to basic training. And I had my friends in college who went a couple weeks ahead of me, and they were in another company, and went to basic training. It was really a Mickey Mouse. I really didn't like the Navy. In fact, when we were training through the Navy. They had us training through these mock ships, and
mm-hmm.
and being an outdoors person like I was, used to the outdoors, the Rocky Mountains that I loved. I loved camping. I loved, in fact, one summer I worked all summer in a camp, living in a tent when I was 15, and I could not see myself locked in a ship.
Hmm.
And being disqualified from most schools, I was becoming very disillusioned again.
Mm-hmm.
Until they started coming out with the hospital corps, and they said that they would waive the color vision requirement for the hospital corps, but that in order to get into the hospital corps, I would have to volunteer, because the Marines use hospital corpsmen for their own medics.
Right.
And to me, that was mean going to land. Mm-hmm. And if it meant going to war, so much the better, because I was used to so much excitement anyway, mm-hmm. and adventure. When I was 11 years old, I had a ruptured appendix, and I had to go back in 1 week later for another operation. I almost didn't survive. When I was 12, I was in a real bad airplane wreck, and I almost didn't survive that. I was laid up for about 6 months. When I was 19, we built a dune buggy, some friends of mine, and we wrecked it, and I was laid up for a long time. That was right before I went to the military.
Wow.
And I was really messed up, and you know, I had I rode rodeo, and I did a lot of really high adventure things, and I loved adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So when they came out with the hospital corps asking for volunteers, and knowing that you would serve with both Marine Corps and Navy, I knew that I would disappoint my dad, but I just couldn't stay in the Navy. I just didn't like the I thought that I would become claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't like the fact that they were just so non-physical in the Navy. There was just, you know, it was all just, you know, you go to schools, and their training actually got out of shape. You know, I would have to exercise at night to stay halfway in shape, because
mm-hmm.
They did not have the physical requirements that I thought they would have. And
you wanted the physical work.
You know, being in athletics, you know, I every night I'd do like, you know, 20, 30 chin-ups, and, you know, 100 push-ups and 300 sit-ups, and that was before I went to bed.
Wow.
Because I'd have to do that just to be halfway in shape.
Uh-huh.
You know, we were state champions in cross country, and I had a school record of the mile, and so I, you know, I loved it. Anyway, so the hospital corps was a way into getting to the Marine Corps, which I would have liked to have done anyway,
mm-hmm.
but just to honor my father, I didn't. And this way, being colorblind, I couldn't get into any school, get into the hospital corps. That would be my excuse.
Sounds like that was almost your fate.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. But I knew nothing about medicine, which made it even more exciting.
Right.
And so I said, wow, it's something I don't know anything about. It'd be fun. So then I volunteered. And then one of my friends who I went to college with, he also went into the Corps. We talked it over together. And there were several of us that decided from New Mexico. In fact, there were about four of us from New Mexico. We decided we were going to go into the hospital corps together.
Mm-hmm.
And we all, I cut my leave short so I could get into the same class as my friends.
So where were you for the basic with the Navy?
And then, San Diego.
In San Diego. And then where did you go for the hospital training?
San Diego.
Okay, you stayed right there.
Yeah.
And tell me about the reaction of your father, especially, once you found out.
He didn't get angry or upset or anything, and I told him that the only problem is that they went with the Marine Corps, and he looked at me, and he was very, very quiet, and he just said, well, he says, just whatever you do, just be careful. That's all he said.
Hmm.
And so, I mean, it was not a bad reaction. I did not feel like fear going home and act of disappointment, but I knew that he was disappointed.
Probably scared for you.
Oh, yeah, very scared. See, I didn't realize what he was scared for. You know, I had no idea what war was like, and to me it was just nothing but an adventure
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the hospital corps training.
It was very good, very intense. Enjoyed it immensely. We went to the hospital corps training,
mm-hmm.
and then right after the hospital corps training, we received our orders. My orders were to field medical school to go with the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And then from there I went to Camp Pendleton. And trained in Camp Pendleton, and that training I began to like because it was a little bit more physical.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of marching, a lot of running, and which I excelled in. And those of us who were in sports, you know, just felt that we at least were doing something physical.
Can you describe a little bit about what that initial the core training was?
Well, I mean, we learned field medicine. We also learned Marine Corps discipline. We had a Marine Corps DI,
mm-hmm.
and who shout at you and yell at you. And because of the discipline of home that I had,
mm-hmm.
Military discipline never even fazed me.
Mm-hmm.
If my dad told me to do something, I knew I had to do it, and that was it.
Now, this was the initial hospital corps training, or is this,
well, this
at
was
Pendleton?
Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
Both. Well, Camp hospital corps training was still Navy.
Right.
And so Navy was there was not much military in that.
Okay.
And the Navy Consul Corps, we went to class all day long, and we're off all evening.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, I played basketball 5 days a week after school. I mean, we played for about 2 or 3 hours after
uh-huh.
school every evening, and the weekends we'd go into town, and I earned more than most people because of my college. I had more rank, and so I earned a total of $122 a month, whereas they earned $60 a month. So I had a $60 paycheck, and they would have a $30 paycheck, which wasn't anything. And I sent half of mine home.
Right.
So we'd go into town and buy bologna and Cokes and go to the beach and spend a night at an all-night theater and 50 cents for a triple feature movie. And,
mm-hmm.
and we'd sleep there. just typical military kid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We just enjoyed ourselves.
Yeah. It sounds like it.
Yeah.
So when you left that, you went to Field Medical School,
uh-huh.
same place, San Diego?
No, this was in Camp Pendleton.
Okay, Camp Pendleton. Tell me a little bit about that training.
It was by Oceanside.
Okay.
Well, there we lived like Marine Corps boot camp people. We
mm-hmm.
Slept in close quarters. We had early morning reveille. We had physical therapy, physical training, the PT. We had to do a lot of Marine Corps exercises, rifle and barbed wire and machine guns over you, and learn military strategy. Plus, also we learned a lot of field medical strategy and how to start IVs and at dark on each other and out in the field. And
mm-hmm.
We had a lot of classroom, it was intermingled with just a lot of good PT. We didn't have. Lee, we couldn't go into town every night. We went to town just, once every couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like a boot camp than anything, which was fine. And most of us are getting here to my friend from New Mexico, and we had started meeting other people, and we were in boot camp together. We all had a good time. None of us really had any problems with discipline. And so to us, it really wasn't even rough. Now, what really woke me up was one letter.
Mm-hmm.
Sent to one guy who was in our company in a barracks at night, and he was reading the letter out loud, and it was from a friend of his who was a corpsman who was in Vietnam.
Okay.
And he read that letter, and it was an eye-opener. All of us were like in shock. He was telling us what it was like being out in the bush, the horrible heat, the thorns, the elephant grass cutting you, the mosquitoes, the malaria, the firefights, the thirst, the monsoons. He said that he hadn't taken a bath in 20 days. He hadn't
mm-hmm.
eaten a hot meal, and he doesn't know when. He had slept on the rocks the whole time that he was out there, and he had his arms all cut up from the thorns and the elephant grass,
mm-hmm.
and every night he'd fight off mosquitoes, and he was on ambush almost every night, patrol almost every day, and the night was just like just as long as the day. They slept in 2-hour increments here and there, and we're listening to this, and whoa, nobody told us about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was talking about the real war. And that's one thing I remember about my whole training.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about the medical field strategy?
There, a lot of it was getting us to learn independent duty, how to be the sole source of medical aid to the personnel out in the field,
mm-hmm.
What to do in case of battle wounds, how to treat them, and just the physiology and the science behind them, and also sanitation, how to keep clean, how to prevent infectious diseases in a very filthy environment, and how we were in charge of all of that. And
mm-hmm. Was it difficult for you to learn all this, or was it
no, a
challenge?
It was always a challenge. It was just school, you're a PhD,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't learn what you learned right now your first year as a freshman. It came in steps.
That's right.
And every year you just learn a little bit more, and that's the way it is in any field. You start out at the basics, and then you go to a little bit more advanced until you get very proficient. It depends on how you want to go.
Hmm. What else about the Marine Corps training, the side of that, do you remember the most?
The camaraderie. The Marines were really stuck together. They very, very disciplined. They never left anybody behind. They had a tremendous spirit of corps, and that they all took pride in what they did, and that's what really impressed me.
How were you with the weapons? I mean, you hunted as a kid.
Oh, it's second nature.
Yeah.
I was a sharpshooter at 15 years old.
So that was a piece of cake for you.
Yeah, it was nothing. The weapons were just. It was just fun. That's all.
Uh-huh. Well, after this training, where did you go?
Went to Long Beach Naval Hospital.
Okay.
And worked in the wards there. Worked in intensive care. Worked there until 1970, towards the summer of 1970, when I finally got my orders to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in apartments. It was really not like a military, just like we were working just in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have uniform to war with just the white pants and a smock, a zippered smock.
Mm.
We went to work, and I mean, that was it. And we didn't have inspections. We didn't stay in barracks, and we didn't. It was like just like living as a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was still Navy. I mean, mind you, we had some military there, but it was learning more on the job of there. And as time went on, I thought for sure that we were not going to go to Vietnam because Nixon was already starting to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
The troops, and this was already 1970, and we thought for sure, and had heard all the stories of all the guys that had been there during Ted and all that,
mm-hmm.
who were stationed with us, and so it looked pretty pretty quiet, pretty dead as far as Vietnam, and the coverage was becoming less and less on television, so we figured that the involvement of the military was less and less, and so
you all kept up with what was happening,
of course, yeah. And none of us were getting sent over, and so it looked like that was going to be it for us. We weren't going to, the war was going to be over by the time, we put in time there. So none of us were actually even thinking about that we would spend time in Vietnam. My dad was same way too. He said, "Oh, good. It looks like you won't be going."
Yeah.
And so we didn't mind not going. We're having too much fun in California.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of Richard Nixon?
Richard Nixon, again here too, it's, as a young person, you have little ideas here and there, and politics wasn't really a big thing for me at the time. Richard Nixon seemed to try his best to pull the troops out, just like everybody wanted him to, but I thought that he was giving in too much to our country. Pretty much of an ambassador to the world, and which was impressive,
mm-hmm.
but he lacks so much charisma that I don't think it'll be generations before people understand the true value of him, the true worth of Richard Nixon. I think he was a much greater man than what the country still even to this day accepts, because they think of him as just a mediocre president,
mm-hmm.
At the time when he was president, I thought he was a mediocre president.
Oh, yeah.
But it was at the time.
Right. So the drawdown is going on. Vietnamization is a new word being introduced to the American public. Paris peace talks going on. And you saw yourself and your friends as relatively safe from not being deployed. But you got the orders in 1970. What was your reaction to that, and what happened?
Well, we had 30 days leave to go home. And we all went home and broke the news to our families. My brother was in California at the time, and he was staying with me, and he was the first to know, and he went home right away, and he didn't tell my parents, and so I went home, and I told them, and I pretty much told them that it looks like it's going to be pretty quiet out there, and I might be working at a hospital or something, and although I didn't know, they They treated me like a young man. They didn't overwhelm me and or make me feel real bad by crying in front of me and all that. They're, you know, when I was in the airport and leaving, they shed some tears and they prayed for me. And very, very supportive, very mm-hmm. supportive. So I didn't feel really sad, like I broke their hearts or anything, and I felt like I had their moral support.
How did you feel, you know, coming home, being there with them, you know, not knowing what laid ahead for you?
Well, I was innocently excited, and looking forward to it. It was like looking forward to another adventure, mm-hmm. and I started trying to run at the hottest time of the day, get used to the heat, yeah. And I put in, you know, 5-6 miles running, and I just tried my best to prepare in that way,
mm-hmm.
but not knowing what to expect. But to me, it was just another adventure at the time.
What were your orders specifically?
1st Marine Division, Da Nang. Very
ominous.
Yeah.
What did you think about that? That order.
I had no idea where Da Nang was. All I knew was I was training with the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
and the stories that I heard was that if I was out in the, that I would probably be out in the bush for some time, but for a short time, mm-hmm. and then back in the rear.
When did you actually go over?
July 1970.
Okay. Describe the flight over and your feelings, you know, what you witnessed on the plane.
Well, 17 hours. 17 hours, we stopped. We made one quick stop to Hawaii, and I quickly got into the airport and got a postcard and mailed it from Hawaii to my folks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 15 minutes in Hawaii, that was it. And then we just made a quick stop in Guam.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, we went on into Da Nang. And most of us didn't know each other. We were, actually, I went there with my friend from New Mexico who we were in college together, went to, we're not in boot camp. He was a couple of weeks ahead of, but we went to core school together. We went to field medical school together, and we're stationed in Long Beach together. And we both got orders, and so we're actually going over to Vietnam together.
Hmm.
But we really didn't talk about it. I mean, I read a book the whole way through, and, you know, it's just nobody was really speaking too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what to expect. And but when we arrived, I remember as the plane going down, seeing all these thatched and tin-roofed houses, and I said, my goodness, looks like a lot of poverty there.
Uh-huh.
And then we landed, and then the door opened, and we stepped out, and it was 127 degrees, 100% humidity,
mm-hmm.
and I had never, never been in a place so hot in my life. And it was like, whoa, here I am. Welcome to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
Welcome to Da Nang, 1970.
Who greeted you, and how did you get processed in?
Oh, it was... this young man, he was a Marine corporal, greeted us and took us in a truck, all of us in a little truck, to go to a deployment center where we were in a barracks. And it was totally air-conditioned, just a fan. I just couldn't believe the heat. And I was just drenched in sweat. We were there. And have you read my book?
Yes, I haven't read the whole thing. I read a majority of it. I read a lot of it.
Okay. In the initial part,
uh-huh.
was just the part that really, really just hit me. Like, and actually, it created the tempo for the rest of the tour.
Yeah.
As I walked into the barracks on the dirt floor, there was this, I tripped over this thing on the ground,
uh-huh.
trying to be this soldier who was very dirty, very filthy. He looked at me and had I didn't have a Marine Corps uniform because I wasn't issued a Marine Corps uniform. I only had my fatigues or what they call utilities, and I didn't have a dress travel uniform. So I had to wear my whites, and I had my Navy whites there. And he looked at me and says, "You're Corman?" I said, "Yes, Sam." And he says, "Look at me. I'm an animal." He says, I'm an animal. You're going to be just like me. I'm a Corman, too."
How'd that hit you?
Whoa. It really hit me like I couldn't speak. I looked at him and I said, "I'm not going to be like him." I vowed not to be like him. And I said, "My God, this guy is filthy. He didn't care about anything." The look in his, I mean, he looked mean. I thought I was looking in the mirror as to what I was going to be like, and I said, I do not want to be like that.
Did he explain to you why, or he just said this?
No, that's all he said. He said, look at me. I'm an animal. You're going to be just like me. Mm. I'm a Corman, too. That's all he said.
Anybody else here?
I don't know. I mean, it just, like, echoed in me, and I was just so taken back. I was just so taken back at it.
When I read that in the book, it hit me as, I mean, this was something shocking and happening all of this, weird time, weird temperatures, weird place, but it hit something emotional in you. Is that right?
Oh, excuse me, very much so. Mm-hmm. It really did. Yeah, all of a sudden, it was real. All of a sudden, it was very, very real. And I thought to myself, I said, this is more real than I thought. It was no longer an adventure. This was like just a filthy, dirty reality.
Mm-hmm. What happened from there?
From there, we were being dispersed. My friend and I were given the opportunity of either going recon or going to a regular grunt unit.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to tell us that the recons really had it made. And he and I both talked it over and decided that they were trying to snow us.
Mm-hmm.
And there really weren't. I mean, how can a recon have it better than the grunts? Than the regular infantry?
Right.
I said, that's not true. So we chose both to go with the infantry. And time would tell that the recon really had it made. The guy was really telling us the truth.
Uh-huh.
He was not trying to snow us at all.
Uh-huh.
And we should have gone recon. Because, I mean, they went out just for a very short period of time. They came back, and they had all the food, they had all the equipment, and where the grunts, I mean, at one time we went out even for 60 days without coming back.
Mm-hmm.
That 60 days without a change of clothes, without shaving, without bathing, 60 days without a hot meal, 60 days of every night just being on an ambush, sleeping in the dirt, 60 days of not knowing if you're going to come back or anything. That was a long time.
When did this operation take place?
There was several operations together.
Yeah. When the 60-day period, was it early on in your...
It was very early on, yeah.
Okay. Tell me, going out, you left Da Nang, and did you join up with your unit then?
Yes, or? We went join up with my unit. I was with 3rd Marine Division, 1st Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And we were greeted at the battalion aid station by the other corpsmen. We stayed about 5 days back in the rear. They're trying to acclimatize us to the temperature by playing basketball, by just doing various duties around, because the heat was just so intense that we were just so drained of our energy. We couldn't hardly do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And playing the basketball, he said, you got to be kidding. The guy out there, he's a muscular guy, Corman, said, you got to play basketball. I ran in the middle of the heat of the day. And he did. I mean, they got us acclimatized.
Mm-hmm. And how many days did you breathe there?
About 5-7 days.
Mm-hmm. Were they kind of telling you about operations and strategy?
Yep.
Or okay.
Well, not strategy. They're just telling us what to expect.
Right. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember what they were telling you?
Nope. They told me a lot, and they issued a lot of equipment to us, and they gave me a lot of pointers, which I really took to heart. And they're telling us how to treat the Marines, and the Marines are your life, and you treat them well, and you do this, and they'll treat you well, and you both are interchangeably coexistent and dependent upon each other. And when you're in a firefight, do this, and you're in a firefight. Well, everything they said was right.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, they taught us a little survival and duties that we had and priorities that we needed to make.
Mm-hmm. How about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's it.
Well, tell me about any kind of indoctrination or information passed you all about the Vietnamese culture and the people and what to expect.
What was given to us about Vietnamese culture back in Camp Pendleton and other places, they told us how it was a family unit, how they had village chiefs, and how But that's about it. You know, it really didn't tell us too much about the culture.
Looking back, do you think that was a problem?
No, because learning it firsthand was the best way you could learn it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could tell me all they want what it was like, but unless I saw it firsthand,
mm-hmm.
into firsthand, we learned it firsthand very easily, very fast.
Okay. Well, Dr. Ordonez, this might be a good time for us to take a break, and then we can pick up next time with, you know, going on the field for the first time.
Okay.
Okay. This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Dr. Robert Ordonez. Today is May 10th, 2006. It's about 2:15 p.m. Central Standard Time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, as is Dr. Ordonez, and I am on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Vietnam Archives interview room. And Dr. Ordonez, you're at your practice, I take it.
Correct.
Okay, well, let's pick up. You had arrived in Vietnam. You had met up with the unit with which you'd be serving. And I wanted to talk about your initial days with the unit and then going out to the field for the first time.
Okay, well, you're talking about just the first few days, but how much time do you want to spend in this?
Whatever you feel like you need to say about it.
Okay.
I would like to know how they interacted with you, being the medic for this group.
Okay. Well, actually, you have to correct a term here. It's okay. A corpsman.
A corpsman, yes, a Navy corpsman.
There's a big difference.
Can you go ahead and
talk to any corpsman? He'll tell you, yes, there's a big difference. No, there is a difference. But the Navy has a hospital corps,
mm-hmm.
in which you volunteer. They just don't assign you. You have to volunteer and have to qualify to get into the hospital corps. And once you complete training through the hospital corps, you can branch off into the various other fields. One of the fields is field medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And those people who become assigned to Marine Corps units have to go through a second course of training in field medical school. And all of this is a whole lot longer than your Army or your Air Force medic training.
Right.
And then there's usually an on-the-job requirement that in which you have your training, OJT, and it varies at various times. So people are usually assigned to hospitals and clinics,
mm-hmm.
and long before they go with the unit. And then once they're with the unit, then they're the sole source. And the difference really is that you're pretty much it when you're out there, and you don't have any backup help because the Marine Corps is a much smaller unit than the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are a Navy trained with Marines, and you're really kind of a breed between the two. You're not Navy, not Marine, but you are in the Navy and you are in the Marines. And so the Marines pretty much adopt the Marine Corpsman, and the Navy gives them up. So anyway, when you're out there, usually the Marine Corps corpsman is much better accepted than your average new guy coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they call them, they have another name for that, it's FNGs, but
oh yeah,
you know, but anyway, they're the new guys coming in. And so the new guys, when they usually come in, they're pretty much ignored. Nobody wants to know the name, and they just kind of fend for themselves,
mm-hmm.
until they prove themselves, and then they kind of blend in. And people don't like to befriend a new person because the high fatality rate, high casualty rate of the new person being somewhat careless and inexperienced,
mm-hmm.
you get to know them, and after a while, it kind of works on you. So people, in order to protect themselves against a lot of the emotions and grief that go along with warfare, they pretty much ignore the new person. And but with the corpsman, however, everybody wants to know the corpsman. Everybody does. So you're very, very well received. And before you know it, you know, all the people are kind of catering up to you, the various people, and then later on you kind of get into your little circle of friends. But it's very interesting that they try their best to keep you alive, so they're going to teach you as much as possible. But still, they treat you like a new guy because you're green,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know anything. And you get in there and you feel very, very awkward because you know you don't know anything. And everything that you've learned seems to have gone out the window. Military, everything, and nobody's really prepared you that well for what you're going to be confronted with.
Mm-hmm.
And you go out there and you have no idea when to eat, if you're to wash or not wash, or how to sleep in the heat, and you know, little simple things like, you know, toiletries and whatnot, and hygiene. You don't really have any earthly idea how to deal with that, because you've never had to deal with that, because everything's really been pretty much regimentalized and scheduled back in the States in your training, and nobody ever talked about those little simple things. It's like, how do you sleep when it's 100 degrees, there's mosquitoes all over, and you're sweating like crazy, and the insect repellent has been washed off by your sweat, and the mosquitoes are eating you alive at night.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sleep?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And just simple things like that. What do you do if, what position do you sleep? You know, what happens if you snore? Things of that nature.
Right.
And so you're taught these things, and so you kind of learn as you go, and then you're confronted. Some people get confronted very, very early with combat. Other people, it takes them a long time to be confronted with combat. Contrary to proper belief, it's not combat every single day,
mm-hmm.
but you're in a combat awareness every day.
Mm-hmm.
And when you first get a glimpse of the combat, I mean, something really happens to you. You really, the big transition does change, and you just all of a sudden realize that you're really there, and especially when there's casualties and you having to take care of them, and that just no longer you're really a new guy.
What happened to you when you first experienced combat as far as your mental state, when you realized, you know, you're really there?
Well, yeah, it's kind of a little thought, because several things go on with you. When you're first there, you anticipate combat, and you hear all these stories, and you think of the worst, and you're scared stiff,
mm-hmm.
and you think that you're going to be in combat every day, but you're not. And then all of a sudden, there's a lot of horsing around that goes on. In my experience, the first place I was placed in was an observation post, mm-hmm. so there was really no patrols and no actual combat.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody said, oh, there's movement out there. And they said, hey, Doc, got a grenade? And I said, yeah. And he says, throw a grenade out there. Well, they knew what it was. and it was a rock ape.
Mm-hmm.
And I threw the grenade, and the grenade came right back.
Oh, really?
But I forgot to take the thumb safety off. And everybody ducked, and I was sitting there standing. And then they said, Doc. And I looked, and then after 4 seconds passed, because it takes 4 seconds from the time you release it,
uh-huh.
for it to go off, it hadn't gone off. And they said, thank God this guy is green.
So the rock ape threw the grenade back at you.
Yeah, because they knew it. Whatever you throw out there, it'll throw right back.
Oh, that's interesting. Why did they have you out there on the OP? Was that just to kind of break you in?
No, that's where my unit was. I was assigned to a unit.
Okay.
And my unit was there. And had they been out on the front, I'd been out on the front.
Okay.
Just to wherever my unit was. And so I had to just be broken in with my unit. So from that point on, that's the unit I was with.
Okay. So you said that the corpsmen were really well received, because I assume because you were the one who was going to save them, to work on them.
Correct.
And they really wanted you to know them.
Right.
Okay. Well, tell me about the first few days of being in the field, and what do you remember happening, and you kind of acclimating to that life?
Well, the acclimation had already occurred. We spent like about 5 days in the rear playing basketball, marching around, and
mm-hmm.
and just getting used to the heat, because it's, I remember asking how hot it was, and I saw a thermometer, it said 127 degrees.
Wow.
It was 100% humidity, and it's just nonstop sweat. And from that point on, I didn't even bother checking on the temperature, because mm-hmm. I knew just, I mean, I had never conceived 110 degrees, much less 127. It is just inconceivable. It is so hot, it's just inconceivable.
How did you...
It just took about 4 or 5 days before you could even function.
What kind of effect did that have on the body for you?
Well, I mean, you're very weak. You're exhausted. You don't know what to do, and it's so uncomfortable. You can't rest because you're so hot.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sleep because you're so hot. You're so tired. And it just, you can't function. And you have a headache because it's so hot. And you try to eat, and the food's almost nauseating because you're so hot. And so then they have you playing a game of basketball, and you're sweating like crazy, can hardly do anything. And after a few days, you get acclimatized, and then you can function. It's still hot,
mm-hmm.
and it's still miserable, but at least you find that you're able to do things, and you're able to eat and sleep and do whatever. But the heat is just, I mean, on your body, you just really sweat, and you just have to drink a lot of water, and that's it.
How much water did you carry?
Well, most people carry 4 canteens. That's a gallon of water. I carried 6. because there's always the individual that didn't have enough, who was suffering from heat exhaustion, and you try to curtail heat stroke, and so you have to carry a little extra water for other people. So I carried a gallon and a half, six canteens of water.
Okay. How often did you run into heat stroke?
I ran into, well, there's a difference between heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Heat
yes.
exhaustion, I ran into that about maybe three or four times, but heat stroke, true heat stroke, where the body quits producing any kind of perspiration,
mm-hmm.
when you can die within a matter of a couple hours, when it's so hot, you go into shock. I experienced that one time.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, you experienced it yourself?
No.
Okay.
A soldier, a
okay.
Marine.
Okay.
I took care of an individual. No, I had never had any of that.
Okay. Well, could you describe what you carried on your person as a corpsman?
Well, of course, your pack. In your pack, you had a bag full of medications, and in that medication, I put them all in one jar because the other corpsman told me how to do it. Because otherwise they'd get too moist or too crushed. And
what kind of medication?
Pills. You put Benadryl, some antibiotics, anti-nausea, cold type medications, aspirins, Tylenol. Then you had your malaria pills that you had to carry separate because we're responsible for distributing those to everybody. You had your battle dressings, lots of battle dressings. You had ace wraps, you had slings, little cravats that you carried with you, little lightweight,
mm-hmm.
and you had a surgical instrument set that you would carry with you. You had a package of morphine with individual injectable tubes that you carried too,
mm-hmm.
Basically that was it. And everything else is just, plus the suture material for suturing
mm-hmm.
out in the field. And you carried your food, which is usually about a week to 10 days worth. And most of us tried to limit the amount of food that we took. We tried to eat 1.5 meals a day because the food was just so heavy. Half of it, if you were lucky, was canned food. The other half, that's the rations, the other half was dehydrated. Most of the time we did not have the dehydrated food because they're just not accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But you wanted to take dehydrated because it was much lighter weight.
Mm-hmm.
You carried your poncho, your rain suit, which was your pants and your jacket.
Mm-hmm.
You carried, I like to have what's called jungle gloves because everything was so sharp, the thorns, elephant grass, everything. And so you'd like to wear jungle gloves, but you usually lost those. It lasted about maybe a week before you lost them or something and
mm-hmm.
tore or something like that. But, you know, I went through jungle gloves about maybe two or three times out over there. The rest of the time I had to just hold everything, be half-cut hands.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have what's called a poncho liner. That was your blanket, insulated nylon type of a blanket that you would tie to the corners of a poncho during rain. You'd have your poncho, which was not only a raincoat, but it was also you snapped it together with another person's, and it was a tent.
Mm-hmm.
Could hold four people, and that was your hooch. You would also use it as a stretcher, too. You use it a lot of different things. Your helmet, black jacket, your ammunition. We carried ammunition just like everybody else, and we'd have to carry mortar rounds because they'd be distributed among everybody else, too.
Mm-hmm.
Your canteens, like we mentioned. You have one canteen cup that you'd cook everything in. You have your heat tabs and all that stuff. Letter writing, personal gear was very, very limited. They always tell you to take extra clothing, but those weighed so much, you really didn't take extra clothing.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you to take, you just took extra socks and maybe one T-shirt or something like that. And toothbrush, toothpaste, you may have had that, but so most of those carried a strong odor, a strong fragrance to it, and they would give your position away, especially at night. So you really didn't brush your teeth or wash because it was just too strong of a smell, the perfume smell.
Mm-hmm.
But I would carry like Fazahex to clean wounds, Betadine, and I'd carry lava soap too because I had no smell. So you ended up brushing your teeth with lava soap and then taking a bath with lava soap with all the pumice and everything, shaving. Well, you didn't even shave after a while. But I learned how to brush my teeth with lava soap.
Huh.
But it was no big deal. Didn't have that bad of a taste. Yeah. It wasn't like Lifebuoy, but it's one my mom used to put in my mouth, and I used to say bad things growing up. That was a red soap, and it was horrible, but lava soap was tolerable. And, you know, diarrhea medicine, Pepto-Bismol, things like that. Okay, mm-hmm. Anyway, no flashlights. One person might have a flashlight. One person might have a shovel, so not everybody had one. And no binoculars. One person might have binoculars in the whole platoon. And so we pretty much shared everything. Letter writing equipment, that was it. That was your gold. You carry that in plastic and plastic bags and guard it with your life. And wash your hands before you wrote so you wouldn't send messy letters back home.
Mm-hmm.
So the letters were everything. And that was really about your only true personal gear that you carried.
Receiving or sending letters?
Receiving letters, you didn't keep your letters. If you lost a letter or if you were captured, the letters would always be sent. The communists would send the addresses back to sympathizers back in the United States, and those sympathizers, the Jane Fondas and all those people,
mm-hmm.
would harass and the families of those people and tell them they're dead and tell them lies and they really just torture them. So we did not keep our letters. We burned them.
Okay. What about your uniform itself?
Well, that's it. You just had what you had on.
Well, what did you wear? Was it...
The Marines use camouflage, mm-hmm. pretty much what they use now, but the Army had the solid drab gray, green, and so ours was... you had a T-shirt. You had your jungle utilities, which is your... long sleeve jungle shirt and your pants, and you had two pairs of socks and your underwear, just maybe one pair, just the dark green kind. But it's just so hot, a lot of guys didn't even wear underwear because it sweats and get jock itch.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really basically our uniform. Plus you had a jungle hat, which is like a floppy hat,
mm-hmm.
and it was really interesting because of the culture. A lot of us would twist it and bend it one way, the other people would put a little wire and do it another way. It depends on what group you ran with as to how you wore your hat, and everybody could identify what group you were with as to how you wore your hat. But anyway, we had a little billed Marine cap, and that cap was really invaluable, and you think of that, why would you use one over there in the jungle? Well, what it would be is you put it on at night, and then you put your blanket over you to guard against mosquitoes,
mm-hmm.
and that little bill in front of your head would create an airspace so that you could breathe.
Hmm.
And so I used it at night so I could breathe.
What about weapons?
Weapons. We were issued a .45 pistol, but oftentimes we carried M16s depending upon what kind of mission we're on, what kind of operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I used both interchangeably, the M16 and the .45 caliber.
Okay. Tell me about... the most common problems you ran into out there, speaking about medical problems?
Medical, well, just infections, jungle, what we call jungle rot, around the boot line. You were in water so much in swamps and everything. People get infections, get fungal infections and skin infections, and you'd have to scrub them and put antibacterial soap, Fizohex, and you'd give them some antibiotics and just try and prevent from leaving and keeping them there. We had a lot of concussions and a lot of cuts, lots of cuts.
Concussions from?
People falling, hitting. Sometimes when rounds would go off, they would get a little hit their head or something like that, mm-hmm. that nature.
Okay.
Sometimes even concussion grenades would ding you out for a while.
Hmm.
Yeah, like if you got artillery or something, a lot of guys would be like in a daze for
right.
a while.
What about, you said there are a lot of cuts.
From the thorns, the rocks, just being out there, people messing around with knives, not knowing how to use them,
mm-hmm.
and the people are always getting cut.
Was there a routine every day that you did to kind of check out the unit?
Yeah, there was. And you, like on Sundays, you pass out your malaria pills. Every day you just go through all the different squads within the platoon and just kind of go over the guys make sure that their feet were fine. The feet were very, very important. Look at their boots, and you encourage them to polish their boots that would kind of keep them from rotting because they're wet so much. But some of the guys didn't want to ever polish the boots. And so they like the tan look, you know, the wasted look on the leather, but that wouldn't last. And so, you know, sometimes I have shoe polish and I make them polish the boots so they save their feet, change their during monsoons, make sure that they take the shoes off once a day, the boots off once a day, and kind of wring their socks out so they wouldn't get trench foot. Because otherwise, you know, you get water all the time. But you have to sleep with your boots on, keep them on almost 24 hours. But if you would air them out for about 10 minutes a day, that would be fine, just taking your shoes off once a day.
Right.
And that kind of get good foot hygiene. Every day, they'd come to you when they had ailments. So in checking them out, you just ask how they're doing. And you just made it kind of a routine as to how they were. But you really didn't have to make rounds because they'd come to you. And, you know, they'd be sick or something, and you try and diagnose them. And here you are, you know, 19, 20-year-old, diagnosing another 19, 20-year-old. And they're calling you Doc and thinking that you're much older and you're like 6 months older than them.
Right. Did they call you Doc?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a term.
Yeah, absolutely. Did they ever call you by anything else?
No. Well, the guys out in the bush always call me Doc. Mm-hmm. The guys back in the rear, they call us Squid.
Oh, yeah.
And which is fine. In fact, I had them made me a dog tag. The said Squid. I said, you know why? I said, what this means? He said, it's a higher form of marine life. and I said, if you want something to do about it, you can. I'm available right over here. And nobody ever took me on.
You've spoken like a marine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you tend to, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do.
Right. Right. Exactly. What was the terrain like where you were?
We were in the mountain type range. We weren't really down in the Mekong. This is an I corridor towards the north, around Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very mountainous. Very jungle filled. It was triple canopy. Triple canopy is where you have like three layers of vegetation, to where light itself doesn't even come in. When light does come in, the rays of light, you see the steam going around it because it's so hot. It's like a greenhouse. And beautiful streams, beautiful vegetation, lots of wild animals, very, very dangerous, snakes, bamboo vipers, apes, and lots of insects. And the one time we even saw a tiger.
Really?
Yeah, it was awesome. The tiger was making its rounds right around us while we were on ambush, and we didn't even know it was there, but we smelled dead meat. And it was a tiger. And it didn't like the way we smelled, so it left.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it large rocks, steep mountains, cliffs, and lots of vines, elephant grass, vegetation. Sometimes it'd take you about an hour to go 75 meters.
Mm.
And just that was with the machete, and the point man would go. It was lots of swamps. Swamps all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
We have to walk across the swamps. We're always having leeches all over us, and just stagnant, stale water. Some of the most beautiful streams I've seen, fresh water there, and just mainly that. Sometimes we're in rice paddies down towards the veals, but not often.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time we're out in the jungles.
Tell me about the animals. Besides the tiger, were you trained to deal with the snake bites and insect bites?
Well, yeah. During our field medical training, we were. And we're just, you know, there's not too much you can do. I mean, there's the pythons that didn't bite, they just crushed. There are the bamboo vipers, which are called two-steppers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two steps and you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else was you could treat, which wasn't much else.
Right.
But so you try not to get bit by snakes.
How often did you see them?
Bamboo viper was right by my side, right by my head one time when I was sleeping.
Mm.
And I killed it. And that was the first and only time I saw a bamboo viper.
Okay.
And I saw some pythons out there, and lots of pythons. A cobra. Yeah, I saw a cobra. It was going to strike me, and a guy shot its head off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The insect population there, I've heard a lot about this. Can you describe it kind of from a medical
Well,
sense?
You know those little roly-poly, what they call potato bugs?
Mm-hmm.
They're so big, we could toss them like a baseball, the size of a baseball when they rolled up.
Wow.
And ants all over the place, spiders, huge spiders. But they're the insects. You know, when you have a very humid, warm environments, you're going to have a lot of insects because they're going to flourish all year long.
Mm-hmm.
Mosquitoes every single night, 12 months a year, every night. And just millions of mosquitoes. Flies were prevalent, but not as much as you'd think. But mosquitoes were not present during the day for some reason.
Hmm. How many cases of malaria did you have to deal with?
Probably about two or three only. But I'm sure there's a lot more that I could not diagnose that people didn't even know they had until later on.
Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with the Dust Bowl teams? Did you have a radio? Did you stay near a radio?
No. Well, our platoon had two radio men, and we didn't have dust off like the Army did. We had the same CH-46s, the double propped
mm-hmm.
helicopters were used for everything for us. We didn't have Hueys. The Army used the Hueys,
mm-hmm.
and so the transport helicopters were the ones that medevaced us out. And so we would, if we'd get into a firefight and have to call the medevac units in. The radio men would do that. The lieutenant would call them, and we'd call them.
Was it a problem that the Chinooks were so much larger than the
They're
Huey?
Not Chinooks. Chinooks are bigger.
Okay, these are the smaller ones.
This is the 46s,
yes.
Yeah.
I know exactly what
Chinooks are large. Uh-huh. These ones were a little bit smaller, but they're larger than Hueys.
Right. Was that ever a problem, the 46s being a little bit larger, getting into areas and spaces?
Well, I mean, you know, when I was growing up, I was middle class. It wasn't until I got to college that I realized that I was poor. You know, you don't know what you don't have until later on when somebody tells you. That's all we had, and so I didn't think that there was a problem at the time. We would try and find an opening where they could land, and they'd land it, no problem. And if they couldn't land, they dropped an extractor and through a jungle penetrator, in which was shaped like a large bullet, and when it got down from it was attached to a cable,
mm-hmm.
you would flip down these flat bars on it that was actually like seats, and a person would straddle it, and you'd tie the wounded individual to the around the cord, and they would extract them out that way.
Okay. Where were you in the column? Was there a position that you stayed in with the platoon? Or were you guys operating in the company, or did you branch off into platoons?
Oh, the biggest unit we ever operated on was a platoon.
Okay.
And we had several operations. There were company-like operations, but those are far and few in between. Most of the time, when we were in patrol, it was squads.
Okay.
And but in the platoon, it varied. The VC would always know who was where by what position you were in. So you try to vary it as much as possible. You try to look at it like a Marine as much as possible, not like a corpsman.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a corpsman out was a big deal because it would demoralize the rest of the platoon.
Right.
And taking out the lieutenant, so nobody wear bars, nobody would give any kind of sign to show that they were really what they were. The only thing that would identify me as a corpsman was my medical bag that I have strapped around my neck, and it looked like retrograde, like explosives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't carry the routine medical bag. I just put everything in a different kind of bag, and that's why oftentimes I carried an M16.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't have to, because if I ever needed an M16, if there's a wounded person, I could just use his. So, you know, that wasn't my job anyway. So, but I would carry it as mainly just for kind of camouflaging myself, so to speak. So I would walk, and I would walk sometimes point at certain times. Most of the time you're in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you were.
Tell me about being targeted, especially since you're a corpsman. How did you feel about that?
Well, the thing is people always say, how'd you feel? For about the first month, you feel. After that, you don't feel anything. One day the chaplain went out to our unit, which were out in Little Hill, and we were having taps for some of the Marines that had died.
Mm-hmm.
And there is like a little service, and he played taps, and his guy came with him and had a little service, and then they flew off. And as they flew off, it hit me like a lead balloon that was my home. That was where I was going to spend the rest of my life, likely, because I would either get captured or killed. I lost all hope about going back home.
Did you really?
And you have to. When you lose hope, you become effective because you're no longer afraid. When you give up hope, yeah, you no longer are worried about the little things. All of a sudden, you're very effective, and it doesn't really matter because you're not going to make it out of there anyway. So you're going to do the best job as you can, and you lose a lot of fear.
Was this something that you all discussed, or
No, what I'm saying is that this is a transition. It's like a metamorphosis. As that helicopter left off taking the chaplain away, it hit me real hard that that's what was happening. And prior to that, I really, really was opposed to a lot of the way that the people talked, their language.
Mm-hmm.
I was opposed to the dialect that they had. There was a mixture of profanity, English, and French and Vietnamese. It was a typical language that all the soldiers spoke. And I didn't speak that way because I really resisted. I didn't want to become like everybody else. I wanted to maintain an individuality.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, when the helicopter was taking off, I realized that no longer was I an individual. That was it. The saying, it don't mean nothing, when the soldier says, it don't mean nothing,
mm-hmm.
that's what they would say to hide their emotions. All of a sudden, I quit feeling. I said, this is it for me. And I started speaking like everybody else. Actually, I became a better soldier at that time. And it was about 6 weeks after I arrived. About 6 weeks, because I remember it was about a month and a half around there. And from that point on, you lose fear. You don't care. You quit caring about anything. You don't dream. You don't talk about home, and because your home is there. And that's it. And because of that, you don't have any opinions. You just function, and that's the way a person survives. Because if you don't, you're going to be a basket case. You're going to be very emotional. You're going to go crazy.
I imagine as a corpsman that was very important for you.
Yeah, you have to numb yourself out in order to function. Because I mean, when we're in firefights and everybody was pinned down, the only one that would actually get up in the firefight and go
mm-hmm.
forward would be the corpsman.
Right.
And which meant that you know your casualty rate was 50%, and if you didn't go, nobody else would, and you couldn't care. You had to do it fearlessly, and the only way you could is if you didn't have the emotion, and it just is something that happens to you. Like I said, it's a metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say how did I feel, how did I feel about this? I didn't. I didn't feel anything. I mean, it was like. You can do point? Okay, I'll do point. Hey, I think I should do this. I think I should take this position. Or I'll go out on patrol. It don't mean nothing, you know. Hey, Doc, you've been going out too much. I don't mean nothing. You need to just go out,
mm-hmm.
and you function,
mm-hmm.
and you become a good soldier.
It was an unconscious process.
Not even unconscious. You know, it was like you numb yourself out to where you have conceded defeat, and conceding defeat, you become fearless.
That's a very interesting way to put it. Did the other Marines transition like this as well?
Everybody did. You had to. And if you didn't, you were useless.
Did you see people who did not and were useless?
A few. And we sent them back to the rear because they were very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I saw actually just about two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very dangerous if they didn't do that.
Tell me about your first experience with combat and what that was like.
Well, it was somewhat of a little, like I say, transition.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little bit of combat in the observation post, but it didn't hit me like it was combat. It was just a lot of adrenaline, a lot of excitement. We were out in the on this operation, and we ran. The NVA ran upon us, and we had a night firefight. I didn't see anything. I saw tracers going off all over the place, and that was it. And I was my heart was racing 100 miles an hour, and I was very excited. But it still didn't hit me as to what happened. It was like, you know, just kind of exciting. That was it. And we were walking out of a, trying to get into some kind of clearing. And when we hit some booby traps, and that's when I saw the Marines get injured and killed. And
for the first time.
For the first time. And I had seen them, I had had a few that got little wounds, flesh wounds, but that's about it. The explosions were going off, and somebody said incoming, and I hit the dirt, and I didn't know what was going on. I was so scared, and all of a sudden they said, "Doc, Doc, the corpsman up, Doc, they want you," and I pretended like I couldn't hear.
Really?
I was so scared. My heart was going 100,000 miles an hour. I was trembling. I couldn't stand, and I could smell the sulfur, the explosion. I could smell the burnt flesh, the blood, all over the place. And then this one guy with his boot, he kind of hit my head. He said, "Doc, they want you." And I said, "Oh, man, I can't pretend anymore." And so I stood up, and my legs were like rubber. I just fell right back down. I was so scared. Mm-hmm. And then so I stood up again and kind of fumbled. And as I was walking, I saw this a person down this ravine, and I saw his boots, and it looked like I couldn't even make out what it was. And I said, "Man, I better let the other corpsman," because I was new, and we still had two corpsmen in our platoon. And I said, "I better let this guy's name is Jody. I said, better let Doc Jody take care of him, because I don't know what I'm doing."
Mm-hmm.
And then so there's these people sprawl all over the place, and Doc Jody was kind of tending to them. And I said, "Hey, did you see so-and-so? Did you see somebody down over there?" I said, "No." He says, "Can you go see him?" I said, is it Doc? I'm busy over here. You go take care of him." I said, "Oh, man." And I could not remember what to do. My mind was blank. And I said, "What do I do?" And then all of a sudden, so I had to go down to tend to this fellow. And I looked at it, and it was one of my buddies. And I kind of recognized, I saw his dog tag, but I couldn't recognize his face. His face was blown. He had a hole in his chest, and I saw his heart pumping, and he was gurgling. And his thumb was sticking out of his shoulder. His hand had been shattered so much that the tissue and everything just ran the hand into the shoulder where there's no bone left, just but the thumb sticking out. It was horrible.
Mm.
And it seemed like every bone in his body was broken. He was the one that caught the booby trap. And I tried to save his life. I did a cricothyrotomy on him. I tried to create an airway with my barrel of my pistol and try to save his life. And I thought, I said, "I don't know what to do." And all of a sudden, people are saying, "Doc, why are you down there? That's the booby trapped area." Not even knowing I went down there. And so I said, "Oh, I need some help." I said, "Come down where I came down," and told them where to come down. So then they helped me, and I watched the guy die. And it was like I couldn't believe this happened. And then all of a sudden, I had this horrible taste in my mouth, and it was like burnt flesh. And sure enough, it was a piece of flesh. When the round went off, it went in my mouth, and I didn't realize it. I got so nauseated.
Wow.
And but I didn't. So we put his body in a poncho and hauled it back up to where everybody else was, and I started helping Dr. Jody take care of all the other people that were injured, and we had to place a perimeter because we didn't know if we were under attack or not, and it turns out we weren't under attack, which is good. And so I was shaking. I was just shaking. This was even before the month was up, you know, before my transition.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, it was before. And I remember the helicopter coming in to take out the wounded and the dead. And I was wishing that I was wounded so I could get on a helicopter. And then on the way back home, we marched out of there, and we had gone through some water, and the water, there's water in my boots, and you have two little vents on the inside arch of each boot, and as I stepped over, the water would squirt, and I remember playing the little game, saying, "I'm going to squirt your foot, I'm going to squirt the other foot, I'm going to squirt the other foot." As I took a step, you know, they would fire at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking about comic stories when I was a little kid, about this male man who was a World War II veteran, and how He was looking at his feet, walking and walking, how he remembered the time during the war where he couldn't even hardly walk because he was so unsafe, and he had dodging bullets and all that stuff. But now here, he couldn't, you know, he was walking like 10 miles a day. And I thought to myself, I said, here I am looking at myself walking. I don't even know how far we're going to get here. But anyway, that was my first exposure to, I guess, real combat.
That's an incredible experience of their very first time out.
Yeah.
A true baptism by fire.
Oh, it was.
What did it sound like? What does combat sound like?
Chaos. Loud sounds. You hear. You have a shock waves from the explosion. You have the smell of the gunpowder. You have burnt flesh. You have yells. Everybody's yelling, and some people are panicking. Some people have it so cool and together. You end up looking at the people who are cool and collected, and they're the ones that are organizing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have a natural talent for being totally composed under fire, and other people just totally blow it under fire.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what to do, and that comes with experience.
Were these your sergeants and officers who could keep it under control?
Corporals, just various individuals. Sometimes mm-hmm. the sergeants would. We had some sergeants that totally lost it under fire. We had corporals that would have to take over,
mm-hmm.
you know, and most of the lieutenants didn't know what to do, and you had to tell them what to do. And occasionally we did have a lieutenant that knew what to do. But you know, the individuals that proved themselves under fire, you couldn't tell who they were until that time came.
Right.
And a lot of them were just the guys who were streetwise back home or anything.
How about you? How were you in under fire after you made that transition?
Well, I actually did very, very well. I did very well. It we were brought, like I told you, we were brought up very disciplined, very loving, and had no problems taking orders. I had no problems thinking on my own. My parents, both mother and father, trained us that way. They trained us to, you know, think for ourselves, be independent, and in working hard as growing up with various jobs, you had to make a lot of decisions, and in athletics, you had to make a lot of decisions. So when the time came under fire, you had a tendency, a person like that has a tendency to kind of take control and make sure that everything is run smoothly. So I never had any problems, and it came very natural for me to keep everybody cool and collected and organized and make sure that everything was done right.
Mm-hmm.
So several times I had to take over military-wise, too, whenever the person in charge was decommissioned or couldn't do it emotionally. So everybody has always looked to me to take over in case we had times like those. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have a little leader. Some people have a natural leadership, and,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know whether mine was natural or acquired. I really think it was acquired. And I would end up taking over.
What was your sense of survival like? I've heard a lot of veterans talk about this innate sense of survival, in that you survived for yourself, but you survived for your buddies beside you. Can you describe that?
Well, I don't know. I've never heard that, but you know what to do to stay alive.
What do you mean?
You know, after a while it becomes so common, so almost instinctively, you walk staggered, you don't walk in a straight line, you don't cluster, you don't speak out loud, you don't, even during rest stops, you keep a distance between you and the other person, because that makes a larger target the target smaller, because when you have a group that becomes a big target, when you have individuals that become very small targets, you're harder to hit. So you stay awake a lot. You wake up very easily. You get in a position where you're always looking. You know what your terrain is like. You know where the best place of escape is. If you do get fired upon, you know, you already know what to do ahead of time before it happens. And you have this combat readiness instinct that just comes upon you to where. If the emergency comes, you're automatically doing it. You're rehearsing a firefight every minute of the day, in every occasion, because if you don't want to get caught off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if you're reading letters, if you're going to sleep, you know ahead of time what you're going to do when everything hits the fan.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does, it saves your life.
Right.
And so, but it just becomes common and almost second nature.
You talked about the smell of burning flesh. How would you describe it?
Well, like a cross between burned chicken wings and a barbecue.
Hmm.
But the burnt feathers is really it more than anything, because that's when you have hair being burnt.
Mm-hmm. So after this experience the first time, how did you feel about your medical skills? Did you question, or did you, you know, seeing this horrific wounding the very first time out, how did it affect you as far as, you know, here's what I need to be prepared for? Was it something completely unexpected?
Well, when it first happened, my mind went blank. I knew absolutely nothing. I didn't even know what to do. I had forgotten everything in that short period, but then after a while, things started coming back, and then after that, I knew exactly what I needed to do. My training all came back.
Mm-hmm. Did it affect you that your first casualty actually died?
Knowing that
you really couldn't do a whole lot.
Well,
anyway.
I mean, no, it didn't cause me to question my capabilities. No, I never did question.
Okay.
Even to this day. Because so, I mean, there's absolutely nothing I could do. When you see a hole in the chest and you see the heart pumping.
Yeah.
I mean, you know that guy's not going to live.
Yeah.
And at the time, it just was such a shock. I was just trying to do whatever possible, and I just didn't know what to do.
Did you talk to him?
He had no face. I mean, his face was just a piece of meat.
Mm-hmm.
I could see a tooth, I could see an eyeball, and gurgling, but he couldn't make out the rest.
Mm-hmm. Did you try to talk to the folks you were helping?
Oh, all the time.
What did you say to him?
No, it's just, hey, things gonna be okay. You know, just you calm them down. You say, you just give them confidence, and you just tell them that, you know, everything's gonna be all right, and to let them know, and to kind of make light of what's going on. And hey, you get to go home, all this
mm-hmm.
stuff, and that is no big deal. Hey, wow, that's cool. You're gonna have a something to brag about when you get back home. You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would you lie to them?
No, never lied.
So even if you knew if they're going to die, well, you know, what would you say? It's going to be okay.
No, if it says, listen, you know, just hold my hand. You're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're going to, you know, God's going to take care of you, and that's it. That's all I would say. I couldn't say anything. I just give them some kind of confidence.
Mm-hmm. What would they say to you?
Nothing. Sometimes they'd be scared. Sometimes they wouldn't say anything.
Would they ask you, you know, talk to me about this, or please tell so-and-so this?
No.
Nothing like that?
Never.
Okay. So why did Corman go forward under fire?
Well, it's your duty. What I mean is that you know that you're the only one that can do anything for anybody, and that's your job, and then mm-hmm. you do it, and there's so much adrenaline involved anyway that you do it.
Did you, well, you know, I've heard that from many Marines, that the ones that they admire the most were the Navy Corpsmen. Did you ever have discussions with them about your duties and what you did, you know, while you were there?
No. No, you did your best to not engage in anything personal about any way that you thought or anything. You just,
mm-hmm.
you talked about cars and girls and,
mm-hmm.
and about the war at hand and the war stories and all that, and then the one person I had any deep conversation with was one friend I had, and you try not to have friends because you didn't want to see them die, and because most people just, you know, didn't try to have friends, but you ended up with at least one, and we talked a lot about different things, but we never really talked about personal things at all.
Even with your close friend?
No. Well, not really, no. Maybe plans, but that's about it. You were so numbed out that you didn't really bring up anything personal. No, not really. You talk about maybe a little bit about your family, know about their family, they know about yours, but that was about it. You wouldn't get into any personal thing about how you felt about anything.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't get into any kind of philosophy, but the kind of philosophy we would, I mean, my friend and I would be about Agatha Christie. And he loved to read Agatha Christie, and I'd read his books, and we'd have a discussion about him, and that's it. You know, in fact, that was our escape. That's the only little vacation we had was, you know, talking about Agatha Christie and all his Hercule Poirot and his mustaches and the wax that he put on his, you know, all his stuff, and he had a little brassiere that he wore at night on his mustaches, and we'd sit there and laugh at the guy and just have a great time just making fun of Hercule Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
But how did he solve that? I didn't get that. And, you know, we'd talk about the different stories. And but as far as the philosophy of everything, we said how much we hated Jane Fonda and all the protesters, and that was about it. So, I mean, you know, it was very superficial.
Right.
I mean, nothing deep at all.
Was this a decision, you know, that you made consciously, or is this something that all the men did?
You did it to protect yourself subconsciously.
So
just like today, let's say that you saw your grandma get run over.
Okay.
And I'm sitting here saying, "Hey, I heard your grandma run over. How did it feel?" And you look at me and said, "Listen, I don't want to talk about it because it hurts you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even want to bring it up because I mean, you don't want to go through that pain again. It is so painful at first." And other people say, "Hey, you know, I heard your grandma got run over. Are you doing okay? How did it happen?" "Oh, well, I don't want to talk about it right now, but, you know, thanks for asking." And you drop it.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you drop it? Because it's painful.
So it's almost a common sense thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's self-preservation. It's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you had anything traumatic in your life? Have you had a car accident?
Yes.
And how bad was it? Was anybody hurt real bad?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about it?
Sure.
No.
No, I understand. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. You don't rarely talk about it, do you? If somebody asks you, you'll tell them more or less and tell them how horrible it was, but not readily.
No, I don't have that problem because it was so long ago. Does the time make a difference?
Time makes a big difference.
What about in country? Did stuff that happened at the beginning of your tour, were you able to talk about it more or at all toward the end of it when you're getting ready to go home?
Well, kind of. Yes and kind of no.
Okay.
You know, the people that you want to talk about it already knew about it,
mm-hmm.
and the people that you didn't care to tell them about it were people back in the rear, so you didn't talk about it to them. So, you know, it's like my friend, he had come in, several months after I had been there, but he was with another unit.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly his unit had seen a whole lot more action than ours, which is the truth. And then later on, I mean, we're like almost ready to go home. And I was being cited for the Bronze Star.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Why?" And then it showed the citations of things that I had done before he came.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, he looked at me and says, "I never knew those things happened." I said, "You never talked about it." And I said, "Well, what's there to talk about?" Yeah, he shrugged his shoulders and that was it.
And that's how it ended?
Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, no big deal. I mean, you know, guys are killed and trying to save lives and that was it.
Doing your duty.
That was it. And he said, yeah. You know, because he knew what it was. I mean, we had been through some rough stuff ourselves. So, I mean, there's really nothing much to talk about.
What about the civilians?
What, here or there?
There and then here.
Well, I mean, it's like that's two different worlds. I mean, over there, we didn't deal with civilians except for in the villages, and they liked you, and we learned their culture, learned some of the language, and that was it. But you know, you couldn't carry on that much of a conversation because of their broken English and our broken Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it wasn't, I like the Vietnamese people tremendously. I like the culture, and I just wish them the best. But mm-hmm. I knew that it was pretty much a lost cause, because once we pulled out, I knew that was going to be it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody did.
I was really asking about when you discuss your action, the Bronze Star, things like that, with civilians. Do they want to know more? I mean, they don't understand really what you did.
Nobody has really asked me any detail. You know, I have a citation here in my office,
mm-hmm.
and it's got the Bronze Star Medal with the Combat V for Valor.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the bottom it has got a citation. It kind of gives a little summary. It's like about a 2-paragraph summary. And it just very briefly runs over it. I've never had one person ask me any details on it. They've read it, and they say, wow, that's all they say is wow. And then they don't ask me any questions.
Do you think they are trying to be respectful? Or
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know whether they're afraid to ask, whether they don't know what to ask, or what. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I've, to this very day, not even my own brother has asked me. Not even my mother.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
no, they've asked me, it's just my dad, who's a World War II veteran,
mm-hmm.
he's the only one that really, really asked me in detail. But he passed away in 1988.
We'll talk about that when we get to that point after the war. I want to ask you about, continue with the Vietnamese people. What did you think about them? You said you liked them.
Yes.
What did you like about them?
Well, their culture, they're very family, very respectful, very honest, very loyal, extremely hard workers. They try to have fun in the most desperate situation. They try to be very happy. They were in such dire straits that they made the best of it. They're very, very, they improvised tremendously, very pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
They're extremely intelligent. It's just on and on.
How did they react to you all when you would come in contact with them?
Very good. They're very helpful, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, a few of them were fearful, but with the Marines, they always liked Marines because we treated them very well.
And they could tell the difference between you and the Army?
Well, yeah, they would say. Mm-hmm. And they knew which unit was which unit. And,
mm-hmm.
and our unit had a very good reputation. They knew that we would never give up. They knew that ours was a very strong, forceful unit. And so they always felt safe when our unit was there.
And you operated in the same area, basically?
No. We went around. When we were in one place, it was like for maybe a couple of weeks, and then we'd go to another place. And we never had a central location. We were what was called a Skylark team, and we were helicoptered all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lived out of our backpacks, and there's a lot of jungles and a few fields here and there.
When did you start doing that?
Almost right after the observation post, almost immediately.
Oh, okay. Well, can you describe that? What was the purpose of it, and what did you do?
We were always ready. We always had to have packs ready and go wherever they flew us. And we went on one operation that lasted about 4 weeks. And then we came back. We went to another place and then did some patrols out of that and didn't go back to the rear for about 2 months.
Hmm.
And so 2 months passed before we even had a hot shower or ate a hot meal. It was like a long time. Or, I hadn't shaved in 2 months by the time I got back. But when we go back to the rear, it's usually about 1 or 2 days, and then we get called out again, and then we go to a different location. Then we just went to a lot of different locations.
And these are just going out on patrol?
We'd go out and land, and they'd chop us out into place. We'd land and do a sweep and then patrol out of that area.
Okay. Can you describe what a typical day was like when you were out doing these things?
Well, yeah. Okay, you wake up in the morning and eat a little breakfast, open up a little can, and kind of figure out what you're going to eat that day. It was already hot that morning. Either you spend the night out on patrol and night ambush, or you're back in the command post, the CP, and then you'd have your assignment for the day, and most of the time is patrolling during the day. If you're out in night patrol, you'd come in at least sleep a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd be patrolling most of the time and sweeping various areas. And in other words, search, you'd look for them, they'd look for you, vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Night, you set up ambushes, and you wake for 2 hours, sleep for 2 hours, wake for 2 hours, sleep for 2 hours. And that's pretty much the way it was all the time. You know, sleep maybe 4 to 6 hours total every night, and always in 2 hour increments. Your meals, you ration them out. So like I said, you eat 1.5 meals because you have to carry everything with you.
Mm-hmm.
And just try to limit what you ate. But you took pleasure in what you ate because that was the only pleasure that you had. There were no times for playing cards, no time for talking or anything like that, because you're, most of the time it was just patrols.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was almost all the time. And sometimes setting up strategies, sometimes just with command post and, you know, just taking care of medical things. So there was really, as far as typical day, there's really no typical day.
Okay. How would you get resupplied?
The helicopters would come in about once every week to 2 weeks. They'd exchange mail, give us some food, sea rations. Sometimes they'd bring a change of clothing every so often, but usually about a month or so would pass before we'd have a new set of clothing. And by that time, your clothes were so dirty and worn out and holes and everything in them, you just threw them back in the pile so they could take back, and hopefully they threw them away or burned them. But that's about it.
Was sleep deprivation a problem?
Was what?
Sleep deprivation.
I'm sure it was, but we didn't recognize it at the time. Sleep deprivation is manifested by fatigue and apathy and just inefficiency. And sometimes you're just so exhausted that it'd be so hot during the middle of the day you'd fall asleep even if it was in sunlight.
Would you describe what a typical patrol was like?
Patrol, you'd have to cover a certain area. You'd walk out and you'd pan yourself out in staggered position, and you try and cover certain areas, and you really, what you're trying to do is draw fire, and you'd walk and look for signs of enemy, and always calling your position as to where you were, so they wouldn't, the friendlies wouldn't fire on you, thinking that you were the enemy yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you would try to walk into one of their ambushes, and so that you could know where they were. And so you're always on the edge. You're always anticipating getting hit, anticipate being mortared. You go through a veil, look for their IDs called kunkuks, and you just try to discover, and that's what a patrol would be like. And hopefully, most of the time you didn't make it back to your command post that night. Means you just spend the night out there, and the next day you completed the patrol, and you'd come back in, mm-hmm. set up an ambush that night. Sometimes it'd take a couple days, and you'd have either squad patrols or what they call killer teams,
mm-hmm.
in which there'd be about 5 to 6 people, go ahead, a couple of killer teams. And you'd operate in smaller groups and move a whole lot faster with much more stealth.
What was the purpose of the killer teams?
Just to move faster and to try and catch them off guard. And you're harder to detect when they're smaller teams.
Mm-hmm. How often would you all make contact?
Not that often, you know, once every 2 or 3 weeks or so.
Would you take some time and describe the enemy, the Viet Cong and the NVA, if you ever encountered them?
Yeah, well, the Viet Cong would engage in a firefight lasting a few minutes, and they never really wore uniforms. They didn't wear the typical black pajamas everybody said they did.
Right.
At least we didn't find that. They'd always scatter, very seldom find them. One time we did capture some, but the North Vietnamese Army, they were just like us. They were uniformed, and they fought till it was over, mm-hmm. forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed like it wouldn't stop. And you knew that was the NVA because the firefight would keep on going, and they wouldn't give up the position.
How often did you run into each? Was it more Viet Cong or?
Oh, VC all the time. Viet Cong much more.
Okay. And you said you captured a couple one time.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience?
Well, we smelled some food cooking. Well, no. First of all, we were sitting and we heard some rustling because one of them was actually looking at us or they're trying to see if we were around, but they never did see us. But we heard some rustling, and we followed him at a distance, and I don't think he knew that we were following him. And then he went to his base camp, and there's his comrades kind of lying around on hammocks, and we just circled them, and that was it. But there was only three of them.
How did they act?
Wow, they were shocked. we didn't shoot any of them. They just put their hands up, and they did, and they got down on the ground, and the choppers came in and took them.
Hmm. What did you think the strengths of the VC were?
Well, they could work within the population without being detected. They knew the land very, very well. They knew jungle warfare a whole lot better than we did, and guerrilla warfare too. They could do without a lot. It seemed like we had to have more equipment than they did.
Mm-hmm. What about their weaknesses?
Weaknesses is that they underestimated us.
How so?
They think that we couldn't see them. They think that we would not sit there and ambush all night. And I think that they didn't think that we were the way we were. Because, you know, if we get fired upon, after a couple of minutes, if they're still firing upon it, we'd do it like a charge and go after them. Even though we're being fired upon, and that scare them to death.
Mm-hmm. They didn't expect you to do that.
No.
What about the NVA? What were their strengths and weaknesses?
I don't know. Their strengths were in numbers, and they're very, very disciplined. Weaknesses, I don't know what their weaknesses were. I never thought about it.
Like they didn't display any, I guess, is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, it's just like it was like fighting Americans. I mean, they were just like us. Mm-hmm. It was kind of scary.
Did you all respect them?
Yeah, very much.
Did you respect the VC?
Yes.
And I guess this is in the sense that you don't underestimate your enemy.
Right.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about, on the medical side, how long someone would be able to be out there without being wounded. I mean, how often, or what was the typical time frame in which someone could operate out there where you were before they had some kind of incident? And I know it varies according to where you are and how many of the enemy are out there. But what did you witness?
Well, some of the guys went the whole time without getting wounded. Most of us did get dinged at least once. But I think about 75% of us got some kind of minor injury.
Mm-hmm.
And some people were unscathed the whole time. I mean, 25% up to maybe 30% are unscathed, but most of us did get some little shrapnel or something.
So that was relatively common?
Yeah. It was no big deal. It was, I mean, you know, I got shrapnel on my butt, didn't even report it. So, you know, it's like, whoa, that was dumb.
Mm-hmm.
I have a little scar there, but...
Mm-hmm. Is that the only time you were wounded?
No, I was getting out of a helicopter and an RPG round hit and blew me off and about 10 feet from the ground and landed on my head and broke my nose and cut it wide open.
Mm. Can you tell me about that? What happened?
Well, we're coming into an operation and the chopper hadn't landed. The first guy jumped out and then I was kind of waiting for him to land and he was about 10 feet off the ground and he thought it was too soft for him to land, so he wanted all of us to jump, and I didn't want to jump. You know, I had about 65 pounds of gear on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw a jet and before I know it, there's a flash, and somebody hit me and just threw me off, and I was airborne. And then I saw the ground coming, and then my helmet crunched my nose as I landed on it, and I heard a crunch, and it hurt, and then I landed and rolled over on my back, and I started seeing red because the blood was all over the place, and then I had a concussion, and they thought I was dead, and I said, no, I'm alive. but I remember thinking that it was the fault of the pilot, and I was kind of crazed, and so I put the magazine in my rifle, and I was going to shoot the helicopter down, and they grabbed the rifle from me.
Wow.
I didn't know what I was doing. But so they put me in another chopper after they put a battle dressing on my nose.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really hurting, so I got in.
So it did not take the chopper out?
No, I didn't shoot.
No, the RPG?
No. I don't know what happened. It was not that big of a round, but I don't know if it was a dud or what went off. I don't know what it was that went off, but I had no shrapnel. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had any shrapnel, so I just don't know.
Hmm. Or like a concussion.
It could be a concussion, but still you have some shrapnel.
Right. Yeah.
I can't explain it.
How long were you evacuated? How long were you away?
18 days.
Okay.
I was in a USS Sanctuary hospital ship for 18 days.
What was the sanctuary like?
Well, I remember we were flying across the ocean, and it looked like we were 2 inches above the water. It's so scary. You know, but I had a horrible headache and somewhat a concussion. I wasn't thinking right. And when it was landing, the ship, I remember looking down, and I saw the ship deck going up and going back down, going up and going back down. I said, this guy better land because I'm not going to jump. So he landed, and it was very wobbly. I had never been in a ship before. And they took all my gear from me and escorted me to... I actually walked. I wasn't even in a stretcher or anything. I walked to a ward, and they examined me. And then they took me to the operating room and then tried to clean me up and stitch my nose up. But the anesthesia never took, and it hurt horribly. It was horrible pain. Horrible when they were cleaning me and trying to stitch me, and they're talking as though I wasn't awake. It was just the most horrible experience. It felt like somebody had a huge tent spike and crammed it up my nostril. It just like cram. It just hurt so bad. The pain was just through my entire head. And I said, I can still feel that. And I said, you don't know you can't. I said, yes, I can. And I gave another shot. And all the shots hurt. And he was stitching me, cutting away dead tissue. And I felt every needle. It was hard.
Why didn't the anesthesia take?
I don't know. I guess my adrenaline was too high. I don't know.
And you were there for 17 more days?
Yeah.
What was the life like there on the ship?
Really strange. I could not sleep on the bed because I hadn't slept in a mattress for months. And it was like sleeping in midair. It was so uncomfortable. I'd forgotten what it was like to sleep in a mattress. We hit a tropical storm, and I got so seasick, it was horrible. And I got in trouble with a nurse out there. She was making fun of me, and I had a hidden grenade in my hand, and I still had a concussion, and I would sit there and getting ready to pull a pin out before some Marines jumped me and took it away from me, and so she made it her point to torture me the whole time I was there.
Oh, gosh.
Because I scared her to death. I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
So when I was seasick, she just came over and says, the ship is going back and forth, back. And I was just so sick.
That's a bit cruel.
They're very cruel. But anyway, made friends with this Republic of Korea Marine. He was a corpsman also. He was there for liaison for the Koreans that would go there. He could speak English and also speak. He was fluent in Korean because he was Korean. He and I made friends. He gave me a uniform. Then made friends with this other guy who was a sailor out there, and I had to wear pajamas the whole time, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
And ate hot meals indoors, slept in air conditioning. It was like, felt like I shouldn't be there. And finally, I got out. The doctor wanted me to stay. He says, I could reassign you here. And I said, no, I got to get back to my man. And he was really perturbed with me. So it was Thanksgiving Day. He says, what are you going to do? Leave today? Thanksgiving. I said, yes, sir. I want to go today. So after a little egg and bacon, I left and hitchhiked to my unit. And by the time I got to my unit, it was the evening. And that was the only meal I ate that day, was that eggs and bacon. I was, didn't get to eat Thanksgiving dinner.
Wow. And you were able to go right back to the same unit?
Yeah, I had to hitchhike all the way to my unit.
Okay. Tell me, while you're talking about the Korean friend you made, tell me about the other Allied troops. Did you ever come in contact with
them?
There was
a couple Australians. And they were just as crazy as we were. All of us are young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And a few Australians and Koreans, and that's all that I met out there.
How would you describe the Australians?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't see any difference between them and us.
What were they doing?
Patrols. They had little certain assignments, but they weren't with us. They were, like, down south,
mm-hmm.
and we just saw them, you know, just back in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, we got patrols and all that, and said, you got to do this? Yeah. And they asked us, do we do that? Yeah, we do the same thing. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing the same thing we were, so
uh-huh.
that was it.
How effective was what you were doing, the patrols and all of that, and making sporadic contact?
Well, you know, it's it wasn't effective at all because we were fighting on their terms.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no fire zones, and they had all free fire zones. And you know, it's something like that, that's why it lasted 10 years, because we were fighting on their terms. And, you know, we didn't fight it on our terms.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a while back that you all would talk strategy, or you would kind of strategize about the patrols. Were you involved in that? Or
yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was a corpsman, and so as far as they're concerned, I was like an officer. But even the lieutenant used to ask me questions, what do you think about this, what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of experience with compass and mapping and orienteering and outdoor experience. I used to hunt a lot, and I could outshoot most of the Marines. I was better shot than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they knew my background, and so they wanted very much. And they knew I had some college behind me, so that made me instantly smart. You know?
Right.
But, I mean, that's just the kind of ancient. And the lieutenants were, he was about a year older than I was, and so I was 21, he was 22. And so he'd always ask me questions, what do you think about this, what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd tell him what my opinion was, and because I was not under the Marines, I was just, you know, kind of like my own boss out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have to do anything, but I would do everything. And so for that reason, they would ask me a lot of military strategy.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you got more respect because you were a corpsman versus the other guys?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Was that a problem with the other guys?
No. No, I mean, it was absolutely zero problem with anybody.
Okay.
Except for a sergeant. And he disdained me. And, we had a confrontation in which he challenged me, and I stood up and said, let's go at it. And he refused. And so he lost respect. So that was it.
What happened?
I was just being a jerk, and I didn't like the way he was doing things.
Can you describe it, or would you rather not?
No, I mean, it's no big deal. It's just petty stuff, that's all.
Well, I'm curious as to what would make you guys want to fight each other.
I didn't like him. He didn't like me. And and when you're in that position where, you know, when you're in war, you carry a lot of hatred with you, and you don't hold anything back. If you don't like somebody, go duke it out with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just kind of like the way it was during that time. It's not like in peacetime where you restrain yourself. You don't have to restrain yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And like the gunnery sergeant, who's Filipino, you're huge. He knew my reputation and just out of jest, he one time took me on, and when we were back in the rear, and he and I wrestled. And, of course, he beat me, but yet the fact that I stood up against him after that, he respected me.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell me, he said, listen, I want you to be promoted, I want you to do all this. And he became an instant friend. And just because I stood up to him, but we weren't angry, I was just drunk. And he said, okay, I want to take you on. They said that you're a bad dude. I said, okay, let's go at it. And I wouldn't give up, and he beat me.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is that the fact that I wouldn't give up meant that I won.
Mm-hmm.
And I won also with my platoon. My platoon from that point, because nobody would ever take on this gunnery sergeant, because he was muscular, he was much more refined, he was very fearful looking, fearsome, and not even any of the other sergeants would ever take him on, but here I was. The fact that I did, it didn't matter if I lost. The fact that I took him on,
mm-hmm.
just all of a sudden, it gave me instant recognition within the platoon, and it was sometime later that that other sergeant wanted to take me on,
mm-hmm.
and so I stood up, and he backed down.
How often does this kind of thing happen within the unit?
Not often at all. Well, I can't say not often. No, not often. No.
And it was kind of a random provocation, or
yeah.
just personalities clashing?
No, random and personality both, but usually it was just the, you know, the stresses of the time.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that stress, being in a war zone.
The stress, you know you can die,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have any inhibitions, and if sometimes you get extremely angry and at an individual, and you'll tell them off, you just display it. I guess you have no inhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
This one guy pulled a .45 pistol up to me. He cocked it, was going to fire. I took it away from him, and it was going to fire back at him. But then I said, "Well, that's Leavenworth. I don't want to do that." And I just publicly humiliated him. But it was things like that happened.
How did you publicly humiliate him?
I said, "Well, I just said I want everybody to look at this little mouse right here.
Mm-hmm.
This little good for nothing." And I just told him off, you know. This little coward is a piece of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And look at that. He was trying to shoot me. And he can't even take out a corpsman.
And that put him in his place.
Yeah.
Why don't we go ahead and stop for today?
Okay.